From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Sigmund Freud described himself as an archaeologist uncovering layers of his patient's psyche. In a new best-selling biography of Freud, Peter Gay uncovers new information about Freud's life and theories. Gay shares some of his findings with us on today's Fresh Air. Also, Alice Hoffman talks with us about her new novel, At Risk. It's the story of an 11-year-old girl who contracted AIDS from a blood transfusion before blood was tested for AIDS. And we have reviews of Marty Jones' new album and Dirty Harry's new movie. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Sigmund Freud once said it was his fate to agitate the sleep of mankind. Cultural historian Peter Gay has written a new biography of Freud. Gay says we all speak Freud today, whether we recognize it or not. We casually refer to repression and projection, neurosis and ambivalence, and sibling rivalry. Yet Gay writes that such glib verbal endorsements have often been damaging to Freud's theories because they rob Freud's thought of its tough-minded realism. Peter Gay has been a professor of history at Yale since 1969. He grew up in Germany in a Jewish family. They fled their country in 1939. Although Gay passionately embraced his new country, America, most of his writing has been about European thought. He's written extensively on the Enlightenment philosophers of the 18th century, and he's written a multi-volume history of the changing values in the bourgeoisie from Victorian times through the Freudian era. Gay's new book, Freud, A Life for Our Time, is a bestseller. There's no shortage of books about Freud. Gay has written several himself, but he still saw a need to further examine Freud's life.
In the last few years, there's been a good deal of writing about him, a lot of it quite scurrilous and a lot of it quite ill-informed. There seems to have been a kind of good deal of psychological, political assault on him, which interested me a good deal, but which in itself wouldn't have been enough, because I knew that I had a couple of major biographies sitting there, the most important one being the three-volume Ernest Jones one by somebody who was there, but published long ago, 53 to 57, in some ways genteel, protective of the family, and so on. And the second thing which really played in with this was that I was able to get hold of a lot of stuff that other people had not been allowed to see, or I was able to re-examine things that had not been handled very well by earlier biographers. So I thought there was a good deal of leeway for somebody to go into this crowded field once again.
Now, you begin your biography by describing how Freud intentionally made it hard on biographers. He destroyed a lot of his papers. Why do you think he did that?
Well, he, being a human being, he was full of contradictions. And one of the most interesting ones was that on the one hand, he is a great radical, digging deep down into the mind in ways that no one else had ever really done before. On the other hand, he was a 19th century bourgeois who was intent on privacy. And as a matter of fact, he acts out that conflict. You can see him, say, in The Interpretation of Dreams, which is full of his own dreams and memories and things that come back to him as he recounts the dreams. He will say, at one point, so far and no further. I've told you a lot about myself, more than anybody else would, and now let me stop. So he had a kind of double role to play, which makes him particularly interesting, at least made him interesting to me as I worked through his life.
But do you feel like you're violating his wishes in a way?
Sure.
And it doesn't bother you?
No. A historian is a voyeur. I mean, we want everything. And, and after all, if Kafka's last request to destroy stuff had been obeyed, we wouldn't have his great novels.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think that besides historic figures like Freud owe it to the past, whatever they may want to think themselves, he had very little faith in biographers, and he probably wouldn't have liked what I wrote either. But no, I have no qualms about that.
You know, in an earlier book, you pointed out that Freud was not a Freudian. And I'm going to ask you to explain what you meant by that.
I have no idea, frankly, what that could have meant. He was a very good Freudian.
Well, you elaborated on it by saying that he wasn't responsible for the myths woven around his name.
Oh, that, of course, sure. I mean, for example, one of the most familiar ones and very tempting ones would be that he was a kind of pope, and he had a college for cardinals around him, and he laid down the law, what it all meant, and anyone who disagreed was subjected to a heresy trial and then thrown out. This is a kind of myth that was encouraged, I think, by some of the true believers, psychoanalysts who, for example, for years and years could not start a paper without looking for some proof text from the master himself. Well, in actuality, while of course there were certain matters about which he felt very strongly and which he thought qualified someone for membership in the psychoanalytic club or did not, just as you would say what is or is not a Catholic, you can lay that down. So Freud thought there were what he called shibboleths of psychoanalysis, the unconscious, the infantile sexuality, the work of the defenses, the developmental scheme that he'd worked out, half a dozen important matters. But at the same time, he was perfectly willing to change his own mind about his own ideas and did so quite drastically and was quite content to have other people do that. So in that sense, I suppose he was not a Freudian.
Knowing as much as you do now about Freud's life, about his family relationships, his friendships, do you think that in a way the relationships he had helped create the models for his theories about relationships? And here's an example that I'm thinking of. You had the chance to read his love letters to his fiancée before they were married. They were engaged 2 months after they met, but they stayed engaged for 4 years before marrying.
Yeah.
And you believe that they were both...
Sorry.
It's okay. You believe that they were both virgins when they married. And during that four-year period when they were engaged, you think that Freud was just really overcome with sexual desire, with unfulfilled sexual desire. It's easy to think that, well, maybe that led to his theory of libido.
Yes. Well, let me say, first of all, I don't put it quite so firmly. I don't know about Freud's early sex life, and I didn't speculate in part because there's really no evidence of any sort one way or the other, so it's a wide open field. Well, you know, the whole question of the intimate, the biographical basis for major theories, such as Freud's psychoanalytic theories, is always interesting. But I would be very cautious about being reductionist, you know, that mm-hmm. something is nothing but. As a matter of fact, I've sometimes told my students this when we talked about it. If you could suppose, for example, that the complete works of Freud had been washed up in some large bottle on some beach, and all the title pages and names had been erased, what would you think of these things? If you knew nothing about the author, then you'd have to go out and test and experiment or try to see by analyzing others how these theories work. So that from a biographical point of view, it's always interesting, and Freud does bring his own life in all the time. But at the same time, he would claim general validity for what he's saying once he's saying it in a kind of global way that he would when he developed his theories. So I don't know. I don't think the libido theory in anyhow was around. The idea that sexuality was important was something that one could have read in Schopenhauer as well. I would not attribute his frustration to the theory to that 4 or 5 years.
I think for women, the most difficult part about Freud is his views on women and on female sexuality. Mm-hmm. He wrote that the sexual life of the adult woman is something of a dark continent. Mm-hmm. And of course you could say, well, maybe to him it was a dark continent, but certainly not to women. And it's this implicit equating of his view or of the male view with the world view. Do you think that he ever knew that he was doing that?
that he was
imposing a male view on women?
Oh, sure, yes. I mean, he himself explicitly says, in the 1920s, when these offensive papers are being written, beginning about 23, and then there's only 4 or 5 of these papers, indeed, that he knew he would be irritating the feminists, but it was just too bad because this is what he thought. I might say, by the way, that's fairly complicated. It's not an issue that I evade at all. I have a long section. You quote the phrase dark continent, and I have a whole long, maybe 30 pages or so on the development of his views on female sexuality. And there's some very curious things about that. First of all, Freud, theoretically, from the beginning, early on, believed that the little girl and the little boy are developing the same way, although obviously physiologically they're the opposite. It is not until after the First World War, when he's in his late 60s, early 70s, that he develops these theoretical notions of the extra work the little girl has to do or that the adolescent girl has to do that have developed then into what feminists have, and I think quite rightly, incidentally, found so offensive. So one has to ask oneself, and I did, Why does he, in his late 60s, as he's revising and rethinking his theories, develop these notions which in some ways, if you think of them politically, are much more old-fashioned than they had been when he started writing psychoanalysis in the late 1890s? And I offer a kind of triple answer. One of them is that he himself has a problem with analyzing his own relations to his mother, which is something he never really did. If you compared that with the careful and tormented analysis he subjected his own relations to his father to, or other men for that matter, you can see that there's something missing here, and I think it's something that he himself was uncomfortable with and never did face completely. Secondly, I think there are certain theoretical, politically quite neutral requirements which had to do with his own knowledge of female and male physiology, something that we at this time have gotten far beyond. And thirdly, there's again the point I made earlier, that in many ways he was a very old-fashioned 19th century middle-class gentleman who had certain views that today are unacceptable, and I think rightly unacceptable. So I think, and also let me say one other thing, which is that psychoanalysts were uneasy with Freud's theories in the 1920s on female sexuality, and he got involved in a major debate, especially with Ernest Jones, who would not budge on a view of women which today would be found much more congenial and, I think, by the way, much more adequate. Mm-hmm. And I think that one reason that this was not resolved was, first of all, Freud was getting very old, and secondly, from 1933 on, when Hitler gets into power in Germany, they have other things to worry about which are not theoretical. So theory, in a way, is left out of the psychoanalytic picture for quite a number of years, and it's not until the feminist movement in the 60s takes up these papers of Freud's, objects to them, that the question has been reopened.
Speaking with Peter Gay about his new biography of Freud, it's called Freud, A Life for Our Time. You know, but you make the point that although Freud saw women as incomplete men, that at the same time, his theories of sexuality subverted middle-class pieties, such as?
Well, again, you see, there you have this duality, which is so interesting, and in some ways, if you like to be simplistic, it's so maddening. Well, middle-class pieties, for example, about monogamy. I mean, he himself points out, and there's a famous letter that he wrote to an American, famous American psychiatrist, James J. Putnam, a Harvard professor, and a great catch for him because Putnam was converted to psychoanalysis late in life. Anyway, he writes to Putnam in 1915 that there's one area and one area alone in which he regards himself as a revolutionary. It's not a word he uses, a radical, and that is in the field of sexual relations, because he believed that the demands of middle-class society, that you have one partner all life, all your life long once you've chosen that partner, was making a tremendous demand on our natural endowment, both on men and on women, as far as that goes. And he thought that this was something that he felt one should write about. And then he himself says, which is tantalizing for the biographer, that he himself had made very limited use, or very little use is his word, of the kind of sexual freedom that he was advocating to others. So that, for example, as early as the mid-90s, when he begins to think about it and laments the rather terrible kind of contraceptives then available, which always, he thought, limited or possibly destroyed the sexual pleasure of the man or the woman who uses them, that he then wonders about what to do about this. And one tentative thought he had was what we would today call premarital affairs between respectable people. That was certainly something that no one else was openly advocating, at least among respectable people.
Now, I have to tell you that when I was in college in the late 60s and early 70s, I felt that I really had to get away from Freud. First of all, feminists were really understanding the way he had misunderstood women and, you know, misdescribed women's sexuality. And then, you know, in English classes, there were Freudian English professors who were doing Freudian analysis of literature. But the interesting thing to me was, in my psychology classes, they were all behaviorists.
Right.
So the psychology department had already completely gotten away from Freud, whereas the English department was totally immersed in Freud.
Yeah, this is very unfortunate, by the way, because in some ways one might say not that the psychology departments had got away from Freud, they hadn't yet got to Freud in some ways.
Oh, you think that's what it was?
Oh, well, that's what I think. Uh-huh. If you look at some of the recent textbooks, incidentally, the kind of college texts that are as safe as you may want them for general psychology course, I read one just recently, a vast one. There's a whole chapter devoted to Freud as a kind of pioneer, even though the behaviorist who writes this textbook, this particular book I have in mind, believes that some of Freud's theories are dubious, some are wrong, but that the general view, namely especially the existence of the unconscious, the existence of psychological defenses and so on, that this is quite defensible. The other reason why I said it's unfortunate is that I am, frankly, quite skeptical of the way in which literature departments, not only, you know, English, but certainly also French and comparative literature and so on, I'm sure you must have seen all of that, use of Freud, which who is really quite tendentious and very partial, and they love the extremists like Lacan and so on. And what these people do not do, it seems to me, is to encourage the only way in which one can really find out where he's right and where he's wrong and where he must be updated, whatever, which is to read, if not all of him, a lot of him, you know? And so what happens is that you are teased by some of these offensive papers, which out of context of his whole thinking, and for that matter, Civilization and Its Discontents, which is a very interesting book, but it stands in a long tradition of Freudian writing, which, without the other writing, simply leaves you dangling and having opinions which are, you know, honorable. Understand? I could understand how you felt when you felt that way.
But,
you know, I've certainly had students, both not only women, but some men students as well, saying the same thing to me, and I've said, yes, I also disagree. Very seriously, and incidentally, so do most psychoanalysts today.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the house organ of the official movement, the Journal of the American Psychoanalytic Association, and put together, as was done actually a dozen years ago, an anthology of writings on female psychology and sexuality, you discover that Freud here is being pushed off into a corner, and that Jones's views, or for that matter Karen Horney's early views, are now regarded as much more standard and acceptable.
I was wondering if there were any other abuses or trivializations of Freud's ideas that really bother you.
Yes, lots. But let me mention one, because I think it's particularly unhappy. And that's the whole business about the so-called seductions theory, his accepting it or inventing it, really, in the early 90s and giving it up in 97. Very briefly, I'm sure you'll recall what it is, namely that every neurosis whatsoever is caused by an actual experience. And the actual experience is a form of sexual seduction or rape, for that matter, of a child, not just girls, by the way, but boys as well, by someone. It doesn't have to be a father. It could have been an older brother or a teacher or a servant in the house or a nursemaid or whatever. Freud gives quite a list, incidentally, and the fathers play rather a small role in those lists. But anyhow, the point was that he quite strongly advocated a theory of an actual event, which was the only possible cause for neuroses. Now, in 97, after having publicly championed that, written about it, lectured in Vienna to an incredulous audience of Viennese doctors, he gives it up, and he gives a lot of reasons why. We don't have time to go into them all, but I think they're quite acceptable. Now, this has been read by a number of people, particularly a lot of social workers who are now dealing so, you know, so bravely with this very rich and terrifying evidence of sexual abuse. This has been taken to mean that Freud denied that this ever happened. Now, this is not the case, absolutely not. In the first place, Freud himself knew of such cases, patients of his own or others whom he knew about and he will write about, who had in fact been sexually abused, actually abused. Secondly, Freud did not say, this never happens. All he said was this. He said, my theory that every neurosis is caused by sexual abuse of a child is wrong, it's untenable, which is to say, there are lots and lots of other causes, including fantasies. He didn't say every girl, let us say, or every young woman who goes to complain, either to the police or to a psychoanalyst, that she was in fact attacked, raped, or seduced, or whatever, as a child. It is not the case that all these stories are untrue, not in the least. What he was saying was, they're not all true. And that's an extremely important difference. I think he might himself have been rather amazed and horrified by what we now have discovered, but then so would nearly everyone else who wrote on such subjects, even from a non-Freudian point of view.
I want to talk with you more about Freud and also a little bit about your life, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Yale professor and cultural historian Peter Gay. He's written extensively about Freud. His new book is a best-selling biography of Freud titled Freud, A Life for Our Time. We'll be back in a few seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Peter Gay is my guest, author of the new best-selling biography of Freud. Now, you've studied Freud, you've studied psychoanalysis, and I wonder how you'd categorize yourself. I think you once called yourself an orthodox Freudian.
Yes, I mean, it's in a way probably an unfortunate word because you think of orthodoxy as something that science should not have, or even a discipline that aspires towards science. And in a way, of course, I'm being, I suppose, a little provocative. But what I mean is that the institute, the psychoanalytic institute in which I worked and from which I graduated, actually, several years ago, the Western New England Institute for Psychoanalysis, is indeed not particularly open to innovations that, say, make very drastic changes, such as what is known in literary studies as French Freud. By the way, this does not mean that they have stood still. I mean, the Child Study Center in New Haven, which has been dominated by Freudian theory, has done a great deal of work, pioneering work, in child psychoanalysis and the understanding of children analytically, which goes way beyond what Freud himself was able to do.
You fled Nazi Germany when you were a teenager, fled with your family.
Yeah.
And you once wrote that it took you a long time to realize the folly of the statement, "The only good German is a dead German." Did it take you a while before you felt that you could write about anything German or even to confront Freud?
Well, Freud would be no problem in this. After all, he was in his own way a victim, so that
in
itself was, of course, not a problem.
Right.
No, you know, there, knowing, being myself the child of refugees and knowing I don't know how many, older or younger, I can only say there's no such thing as a correct attitude to the Nazi experience. I mean, it's all over the lot. There are those people who will not go back to Germany, and this included me for a number of years. It was, we left in 1939. I did not go back until 1960, and then it was a very tense time, and it was not until the middle and late 60s when I made some good German friends, so-called Aryans, who had been victimized, even whose families had been wiped out far more than, had far more victims to the Nazis than my own. I lost two of my aunts, and also finally coming around to the point that my father had made to me all along, which was that you don't condemn a whole nation for the acts of maybe a lot of people. It is still not easy. I'm there often. I have spent summers there. I've spent a year there and so on. I feel very much at home there. On the other hand, I am very distinctly aware that this is somewhat uneasy even so. Yes, it took me years to read German, to write on German subjects and so on, but by the time I got around to doing my doctoral dissertation around 1950, since I was on a German socialist, by the way, a Jew also, Eduard Bernstein, I pretty well had to deal with German subjects, and I did. Yes, it took me quite a while to accept any kind of sensible, what I now think of as a sensible view, which is to be skeptical of any kind of extreme, either embracing Germany as an ideal country, or for that matter, rejecting it totally and not buying German cars or whatever else.
Freud put himself through extensive self-analysis, and that was the basis of some of his writings.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever done that yourself?
No. I haven't, and I think it's extremely difficult. There have been some books on the subject, and attempts have been made. In some ways, I suppose, you try to do a little bit of it after your formal analysis is over, and I suppose I do some of it too, which is to say simply you stop yourself and say, why do I care that much about something that doesn't seem to matter? Why do I get so angry? Why do I take offense at something that appears minimal or ought to be once you look at it from the outside? But that's about as far as I would go. Freud's self-analysis was, of course, the only thing he could do because there wasn't any analyst around, was there?
Right, that's
a good
point.
He had really to invent the whole thing. And it's, by the way, still somewhat mysterious to me, although I know a lot about the man after all, and have spent a lot of time with him, precisely how he did it. He talks about the fact that he wrote down his own slips of the tongue, that he analyzed his own dreams. Did he lie down on his couch? I don't know. I sometimes like to think he used to take a daily walk after the midday meal, which is always, you know, the big German-Austrian meal, go to buy his cigars or buy a paper or stop by his publishers to leave off some proofs or whatever. And he took a kind of a routine walk through Vienna every afternoon, or almost every afternoon. Did he do it then? I don't know. Unfortunately, this is something he never wrote about, beyond simply saying, I use my dreams and my slips.
Since Freud pioneered dream analysis, I'm wondering if you ever have any dreams about Freud, given how immersed you are in studying his life.
No, actually, I don't think I have. And I must confess that one of my irritations with myself is that analysis of my own dreams, something I was taught to do, has been very hit or miss. And I feel less competent about this than I do with thinking about other people's dreams for some reason. That's my own problem.
One last question. You've written so much about the history of ideas in the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. And I'd really like to just know briefly some of the pleasures that it brings you to write about the history of ideas.
Well, I mean, I think in a certain sense the kind of psychoanalytic history that I've been doing the last 10, 12 years or so is really an extension inward, if you wish, extension of work I began doing when I started writing in the early 50s, when I think I even coined the phrase the social history of ideas, when I moved outward. I was always interested in context. How do ideas get themselves formulated in the language of the times? How do they get accepted, read and misread, extended, vulgarized, modified, and so on, by cultural, economic, political, religious environments? And then in the 70s, I began asking, how do ideas get themselves originated? And I think what I've been hoping for somewhere is a kind of synthesis of a kind of total picture of what ideas are like, how they originate, how they get formulated, what histories they have on their own once they leave the author or authors, and so on. It's a great pleasure to think about other people, and I must say that writing the Freud biography was really a new experience, which is very nice in one's own early 60s, mid-60s now, to have a new experience, because writing a biography of a man of ideas is quite different from writing the history of ideas, which tends to be much more outward and external. But yes, the pleasures have been very, very great, and they continue to be. I enjoy, as I said earlier, I enjoy reading other people's mail.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your work. Thank you.
Thank you.
My guest has been Peter Gay. He's a professor at Yale and a cultural historian and the author of the new biography, Freud, A Life for Our Time, which is published by Norton. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Sid Mead, and he's Hollywood's premier visual futurist, so he's come up with landscapes for the films Blade Runner, Tron, Aliens, 2010, and Star Trek, among others. He's also created many designs for consumer products, and he's also currently designing a theme park in Japan. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks feature the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Writer Alice Hoffman asked herself how would she react if her son's classmate had AIDS. That question led to her new novel, At Risk. It's the story of a girl in a small New England town who contracted AIDS through a contaminated blood transfusion in the early days of the disease. Coming up, we talk with Alice Hoffman. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Used Guitars, the third album from singer Marty Jones. Ken says it's an example of Third Time's the Charm. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new Dirty Harry movie, The Deadpool. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Vice President Bush today defended the United States in a United Nations Security Council debate on the shooting down of Iran Air Flight 655. NPR's Mike Schuster reports.
Iran's foreign minister today told the Security Council that the downing of Flight 655 was a criminal attack and a premeditated act. And the Iranian read from what he said is a transcript of the pilot's conversations immediately before it was shot from the sky. The transcripts, according to the Iranian, showed no evidence that the pilot was warned by the Navy ship Vincennes. Vice President Bush ripped into the Iranian charges.
The wild allegations by the Iran side that the attack on this airliner was premeditated is offensive and it is absurd.
Bush expressed American regret for the action, but said the Iranians bore some of the responsibility for allowing the jet to fly into a combat zone. I'm Mike Schuster at the United Nations.
Major commercial banks today raised their prime lending rates by a half point to 9.5%. New York's Chase Manhattan Bank led the way, followed by other large financial institutions, including Citibank, Bank of New York, and Manufacturers Hanover. The increase was the first since May and raises the prime rate to its highest level in more than 2 years. Analysts say the rise reflects the Federal Reserve Board's concern about the possibility of higher inflation. Both houses of Congress today approved an almost $300 billion defense bill. President Reagan has threatened to veto the measure because it contains several arms control provisions. NPR's Cokie Roberts reports.
Democrats and Republicans in the House and Senate reached agreement on the defense bill, which passed by large margins in both houses today. But the Reagan administration opposes several provisions in the measure, and Defense Secretary Frank Carlucci is reported to have recommended a presidential veto. The Pentagon objects to the lack of funds for testing anti-satellite weapons, even though the bill removes the ban on such testing. The measure also keeps in place certain limitations under the SALT II agreement and limits the number of tests for the Strategic Defense Initiative to those already planned. Funding for the SDI is set at a little over $4 billion. The same amount of spending is authorized for MX and Midget Man missiles. Democrats argue that even though all of the arms control issues were watered down in the conference committee, they scored a victory by holding the line on arms control until the election of a new president. I'm Cokie Roberts in Washington.
Carlos Salinas has been declared the new president of Mexico by the country's Federal Election Commission. But opposition leaders today insisted Salinas' ruling party stole last week's election. Final results announced last night gave Salinas the slimmest margin of victory in the 59-year history of the governing Institutional Revolutionary Party, or PRI. The Election Commission is dominated by the PRI. Opposition members are charging fraud, saying the release of final results was delayed to allow tampering with vote totals. Commission results showed that the opposition won 4 seats in Mexico's 64-seat Senate. In the Soviet Union, strikes and rallies continue today in the Nagorno-Karabakh region of Azerbaijan. Thousands of Armenians took to the streets to press demands that the region be transferred from predominantly Muslim Azerbaijan to neighboring Soviet Armenia. In the wake of the ethnic dispute, the government newspaper Izvestia today reported that the Communist Party boss of the Armenian capital city of Yerevan has been replaced 10 days after a general strike began in that city. Stock prices were higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 9 points to close at 2111.62. Advances led decline 7-6 on volume of 173 million shares. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Used Guitars is the title of a new album from singer Marty Jones. And rock critic Ken Tucker says it's her best. From that album, here's Jones singing a song written by John Hiatt called The Real One.
Press release sent out by A&M Records with Used Guitars quotes the record's producer, Don Dixon, as saying, quote, "This is more than a collection of great songs from Marty. She felt her new album had to have structure, brilliant songwriting, and immediacy." Now, read between the lines, and the real message is pretty clear. This is Marty's third album, and if she doesn't move beyond being a critic's darling, if she doesn't get a hit, in other words, she's going to be shopping around for another record label. As it turns out, that sort of commercial pressure has done what it often accomplishes in popular art. It's inspired fine, clear work, free of pretension or self-indulgence. Marty Jones's earlier albums are very good indeed, but Used Guitars is the record that reaches out to an audience that has never heard her before and makes a convincing argument about why you'll want to listen. That's Keep Me in the Dark, a song written by Janice Ian, yes, society's child herself, and Kai Fleming, a very successful Nashville songwriter. Marty Jones isn't a country singer, although she partakes of country's forthright declarations of melancholy, and she isn't especially autobiographical the way we remember Janice Ian laying out her life in her early music. Instead, Jones is a versatile pop singer who tackles a range of songs, submitting them to her own strong style. On her earlier albums, she covered songs by writers as various as Elvis Costello, David Bowie, and Marshall Crenshaw. On this new one, she dives into a wonderfully self-pitying tune by Jackie DeShannon called Each Time. I like the deceptive quality of Marty Jones's voice. She always sounds faintly hoarse, and when she holds a note, it takes on a reedy quality that makes her throat sound thick with something. Passion, guilt, sadness, sarcasm, maybe just phlegm. It's a very intimate voice, one that sounds as if it's confiding the truth in a lyric.
Take it.
Even on that song, whose message couldn't be clearer, there's a muffled ambivalence to Marty Jones. There's something tentative about the way she phrases, as if she's thinking about contradicting any assertion she makes. I think that on some level, this is one reason she isn't a bigger star. Music like this might not stand up to repeated playing on the radio, sandwiched between the steamroller aggressiveness of Whitney Houston or even the all-stops-out belting of Jennifer Warnes, who in some respects Marty Jones resembles. But ultimately, it's Marty Jones's vagueness that makes her so interesting. Her fuzzy tone is confiding and sexy, and her hesitation seems to be that of an intelligent person taking stock of herself.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's more from Marty Jones.
I'm tempted to hide away. I'm tempted to hide in a tourist town.
This is Fresh Air. Novelist Alice Hoffman sees the world as a place filled with dangers, both real and imagined. In her novel Illumination Night, the main character was an agoraphobic, someone who was afraid to leave the house. Hoffman's new novel, At Risk, is about a family whose child will die of AIDS. Several parents in the community fear for their healthy children and transfer their children to another school. Hoffman has no direct experience with AIDS. She's a mother of two healthy children. She found that writing a book about the death of a child was a painful yet liberating experience.
What it made me realize is that, in effect, no matter how good a mother you are, you can't protect your children from all the dangers in this world. And that even if you can't, it doesn't mean that you're not a good parent. And in some ways, that's a relief. In some ways, that's also a horrible reality.
I'd like for you to read a passage from At Risk.
Okay. This is a passage very early on in the novel where the daughter, Amanda, who's an 11-year-old gymnast, is just getting sick. And Polly, her mother, goes back after a gymnastics meet looking for her daughter. Too much excitement, Polly thinks. Too much pressure. She puts her palm against Amanda's forehead and realizes that her daughter has a fever, a high one. Polly reaches the taps and turns off the hot. Then cups her hand so she can scoop cold water over Amanda's face. They are facing each other, with Amanda leaning against her so that Polly is soaked through her clothes. I'm freezing, Amanda says. In fact, she is hotter than before. Polly drags Amanda out of the shower, sits her on a bench, then grabs a towel and wraps it around her. She runs to the locker, gets a pink gym bag, then runs back and quickly begins to dress her daughter. Amanda feels heavy, as limp as straw. Ow, Amanda says, as Polly maneuvers one leg into a pair of shorts. Polly gently touches the back of Amanda's knee and feels that the joint is swollen. She finishes dressing Amanda and helps her to stand. You'll be better in the morning, Polly says. It's what she's always says when the children are sick, and they always believe her. But this time Polly is wrong. Just after dusk, the rain will begin, but it won't bring any relief. In the morning, the last day of August and the hottest on record, Amanda will still be shivering beneath two cotton quilts.
Can I point out that there's no death scene in your novel?
Mm-hmm. That's right, there isn't.
And why isn't there?
Well, it's an interesting question for several reasons. One is because I thought it was more about the survivors and what's going to happen and how they react. Another thing is that a writer, I felt that it was too cruel a thing to do to my characters. I mean, we know what's going to end. You know, readers, we know what's going to happen at the end. What's important is how people react and how they deal with it.
Did you do research writing the book?
Well, I decided not to because what I usually do and what I did this time was I did it after I wrote the book because I didn't want it to become a medical novel. You know, I wanted it to be a human novel, a novel about a family. And so I did research after I was done writing it.
That's an interesting technique. Did you find anything in the novel that you felt you had to change based on the research you did after you wrote it?
I did. There were medical facts that were wrong, and I had a friend who's a writer and a doctor read the manuscript and help me out with that.
You know, there is a growing body of AIDS literature, mm-hmm. mostly written by people who either have AIDS or who have witnessed the death of lovers mm-hmm. or friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some people are uncomfortable by... I think some people think that only the people who have really been touched by AIDS are worthy about writing about it. And for others, mm-hmm. it's just a device for dramatic effect in a plot.
You know, it's a funny thing, you know, which I didn't realize, but there are a lot of people, not people exactly, but there are a lot of reviewers who feel that AIDS is not a worthy literary subject. I find that incredibly shocking. I think it's a tremendously important subject. I think there are lots of books to be written about it. My book is one, and one small aspect. And, you know, it's not the story of AIDS. It's the story of a family. I think AIDS should be important to all of us. And I don't think that you need to have had AIDS to write about it.
I want to ask you something about a previous novel called Illumination Night.
Mm-hmm.
There's a character in that novel who's agoraphobic, mm-hmm. and she wonders if phobics comb the newspaper for crimes and disasters that corroborate their worldview.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if in a way there was an element of that in your choice of AIDS, a subject matter, of it kind of corroborating your worldview.
Well, certainly I think that I tend to... be aware of dangers, and that's my focus, and how to kind of overcome these dangers or come to terms with them or somehow get by in spite of them. And I think that in a way is true. I mean, that's kind of my orientation. Yeah.
Now, from what I've read about you, you yourself are a recovered agoraphobic. Now, agoraphobia is an irrational problem, but a real and serious problem.
But I have to say, anyone's ever recovered. I think it's recovering is more like it.
Mm-hmm. When you realized that you had agoraphobia, were you already mm-hmm. a writer?
No, I wasn't.
It seems like such an interesting phobia for a writer to have, especially a writer like you who really doesn't go out and do research but mm-hmm. spends her time at home imagining things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, because that's... You're in the house thinking, imagining most of the time.
Yeah. Well, it's true. I think that the writer's imagination and the phobic's imagination are very alike, because what phobics do is when they approach a bridge, they think, what if? What if this bridge falls? What if my car falls off it? And I think that writers do the same thing.
Illumination Night, in which the main character was agoraphobic, mm-hmm. was that written after you felt that you could cope with it?
Well, I have to say that when I was writing panic attacks, which is what the character Vani has, I certainly felt them as I was writing them. And one of the reasons I wanted to write that was because I'd never read about it. I'd read, you know, nonfiction self-help books about agoraphobia, but I'd never read a description of what happens in your mind and how you feel when a panic attack comes on. And I felt that was important to write about. I mean, I don't think it helped me or didn't help me. You know, I don't think really of writing novels as therapy. Usually I think of it as a way of stepping out of my life into another world.
There's one other thing I wanted to ask you, and it just escaped my mind, so forgive me for a second while I collect
sure.
my thoughts.
But, you know, Carrie?
Yeah.
You know, one thing that I wanted to say is
sure.
that I wrote the book for myself. And now that it's published, you, I wish that for my readers the same thing that happened to me writing it would happen to them reading it, which is to in a way, not get past their fears, but realize that they have fears and that it doesn't mean you're a bad person, doesn't mean that bad thoughts mean that you're going to do bad actions. And I think it's very important for people to respond in an honorable, moral way to a situation like AIDS. And I think that's really the reason that I wrote the book.
In other words, you think if you have a fear that you realize is an irrational fear,
mm-hmm.
accept the fact that you have the fear, but don't act on it.
Exactly, yeah.
Is that something you learned in phobic groups that you attended? Is that something you've learned in therapy?
Well, no, you know, that might be partially true, but I think it's more something that I've learned from having children.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, every time you go any place with a child, if you have a certain imagination, every time you go to a playground, you know that in the next moment something could happen. And you know that the world is a dangerous place. But, you know, I think having children has made me realize that the world is also a wonderful place, and it doesn't, that kind of danger, it's there, but it doesn't mean that it's going to happen. It doesn't mean that you're going to have to deal with it.
Alice Hoffman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Alice Hoffman's new novel, At Risk, is published by Putnam. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's happening on All Things Considered this evening. Renee Montaigne is joining us from NPR Studios in Washington, D.C. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story is he following?
Well, George Bush was at the U.N. today to defend the U.S. position in the downing of Iran Air Flight 655. The vice president pointed the finger at Iran. He said that Iran should share the responsibility for the tragedy since that country defied the United Nations resolution calling for an end to the war with Iraq. Also, we talked to musician Vernon Reid, whose band Living Color is unusual among rock and rollers. It's all black. Vernon Reid helped found a group in New York called the Black Rock Coalition, which is made up of young black rockers who are aiming to reclaim musical territory created by people like Chuck Berry.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Clint Eastwood is back as Dirty Harry in The Deadpool. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of the latest adventures of San Francisco's vigilante cop.
Clint Eastwood is famous for making his movies quickly and under budget, and The Deadpool is no exception. Eastwood reportedly churned out this action quickie as part of a deal he made with Warner Brothers. He would do another Dirty Harry picture if Warners let him make a biography of the great jazz saxophonist Charlie Parker. Agreed. And so Eastwood lavished all his loving care on the 3-hour opus Bird, and then did a paint-by-numbers job on the Deadpool in record time. It shows. Even Dirty Harry's patented snarl seems perfunctory in the Deadpool. Here he is, for instance, threatening an imprisoned gang leader who's been trying to get him killed.
See that gorilla down there? That's Butcher Hicks. And he's killed 3 men. You know how he did it? He tore them apart with his teeth. Didn't even find all the pieces. You might say he has an unhealthy appetite.
So what?
So Hicks here is my new pen pal. I'm going to be sending him a letter once a week. I'm going to be telling him how I'm going to be looking in on his sick mother and how I'm trying to get him special privileges here at the prison. And you know what's the interesting part? The interesting part is if anything happens to me and Hicks doesn't get his letter, he's going to be really pissed off and he's going to come down here and see you because you're the mailman. In fact, he'll probably come down here to this post office and cancel your ass like a stamp. So you better ensure prompt, courteous delivery and pray that nothing happens to me.
There's something sludgy about that scene, something slipshod and half-written, and the same applies to nearly every aspect of this movie. The plot centers on a nasty game played by some of San Francisco's more urbane culture vultures. They bet on which local celebrities are most likely to die in the near future, and whoever picks the next genuinely doomed luminary wins. Naturally, Dirty Harry Callahan's name shows up on the list, whereupon everyone in the Bay Area seems out to do him in. Everyone, that is, except for an attractive TV reporter played by Patricia Clarkson. Clarkson was probably cast for her bouncin' and behavin' hair, but unfortunately she has a voice that sounds like an electric toothbrush having its way with your tartar, and Eastwood himself is even more stiff and cranky than usual. The screenwriter, Steve Sharon, and the nominal director, Buddy Van Horn, have stuck in some business about heavy metal music and cult horror movies, but it all seems much less hip and cheeky than it's meant to. The pop culture references feel at least a decade old. It says something about this movie that the best thing in it is the car chase. In fact, the car chase is the most inventive we've seen in years, but the Deadpool can't even fulfill its most basic requisite, that we come away from it with a tough guy catchphrase we can use on our friends. You know what I'm talking about. In the last Dirty Harry movie, Sudden Impact, it was the immortal "Make My Day." But it's a sign of the Deadpool's miscalculation that its catchphrase is too obscene to be repeated over the airwaves. And what good is a Dirty Harry movie if it can't be quoted by the President of the United States?
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57th. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I speak with photojournalist Eli Reed. His new book of photos, Beirut, City of Regrets, shows how the once charmed city became a place of cruelty and hatred. The Lebanese Civil War is just one of the many battle zones that Reed has photographed. Also, Brazilian guitarist Orlando Haddad performs a song by composer Antonio Carlos Jobim. And Ken Tucker reviews the instructional home video, So You Want to Be a Gambler. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistants from Dan Cornwell and Deirdre Benzing. Our engineer is Audrey Vablaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.